The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Williamson County Sheriff Jim Boutwell said of Interstate 35 in 1981, "It was just a convenient place to dump bodies. There's just a hell of a lot of sin that goes up and down that highway." From Oklahoma City to San Marcos, Texas, there is an approximate 400-mile stretch of I-35 where multiple homicides occurred, or bodies were discarded, from the years 1976 to 1981. 21 homicide victims, few arrests, and several victims remain unidentified. It's unlikely to law enforcement that all these depraved acts were committed by a single individual, especially considering the distance involved. That makes it likely, then, that there were several individuals taking advantage of opportunity, leaving an unbelievable count of slain victims in such a short period. To some law enforcement officials, this stretch of road became referred to as the Bloody Route. The following doesn't include all 21 victims linked to the Bloody Route, unfortunately, but information on a majority of the victims is scarce. Some victims' names are even elusive. The murder of 20-year-old Lisa Rhea Haley of Oklahoma City was considered the beginning of what would become a string of unsolved homicides spanning the 400-mile stretch of Interstate 35. After leaving her job with the Oklahoma Resource Board as a draftsman on Friday, August 16, 1976, Lisa joined friends on a trip to Corpus Christi, Texas. She then accompanied them to Austin, where her friends would stay. But Lisa's plan was to hitchhike back home. She was last seen by her friends on Wednesday, August 21st, when they drove her to the northbound side of I-35, where she would begin hitchhiking back to Oklahoma City alone. A witness saw Lisa getting into a van in the Waco area, and this would be the last time anyone would see the young woman alive. On Friday, August 23rd, 1976, exactly a week after she left her Oklahoma City home, Lisa Rhea Haley's body was discovered in a ditch off I-35, about 2 miles north of Waxahachie, Texas, near Red Oak, and just south of the Dallas County line. Lisa was fully clothed, except for her shoes, which were never found. The young woman had been ruthlessly bludgeoned in the head and face with an unknown blunt object. Lisa was also struck at the base of the skull with an awl, which was still present, protruding from her neck. The medical examiner determined that it was the blunt force trauma to the head that killed Lisa. There was no sign of sexual assault. It would take 2 weeks for Lisa to be identified by dental records supplied by her parents. The murder of Lisa Rhea Haley remains unsolved. On Wednesday, October 31st, 1979, two men were driving along the southbound two-way access road of Interstate 35, just north of Georgetown, Texas, in Williamson County. As they traveled past a culvert that tunneled under the major highway, something unthinkably horrific caught their attention. The naked body of a woman laid at the mouth of the drainage structure. Unclothed, that is, except for a pair of distinctly orange socks. The men phoned the sheriff's office, which in 1979 is something that one or both would have had to have left the scene to do, of course. They returned to the scene and awaited law enforcement's arrival. Sheriff's office deputies collected possible evidence at the scene and took photographs. The deceased woman was estimated to be in her 20s, was Caucasian with hazel eyes and reddish-brown hair. She was above the average height for a female, standing between 5 feet 8 inches and 5 feet 10 inches tall. She weighed between 140 and 160 pounds. If you're confused as to the exact reason this woman's height and weight descriptions aren't given with a little more certainty than that, you're not alone. Among the items police picked up were two matchbooks. One of the matchbooks bore the name of Holiday Inn in Henrietta, Oklahoma, the other Motel 6. It's common thought that these items help affirm the theory that the young woman was a drifter or hitchhiker. However, it's difficult to imagine that the matchbooks actually belonged to her, considering she was found nude. Beyond the books of matches and, of course, the bright orange socks, the only other specific identifiers were a quarter-inch hairline scar under the woman's chin and a silver-colored ring that contained a long, thin, whitish-blue, oval-shaped fixture, which is described as either an abalone shell or mother-of-pearl stone. Another detail that, it seems, law enforcement could have provided more certainty, as it couldn't be difficult to determine if the ring is abalone or mother-of-pearl. Few leads or clues materialized that pointed investigators in the direction of the perpetrator of this Jane Doe's murder. At about 2:30 a.m. that morning, while on routine patrol, Sergeant Red Watson of the Williamson County Sheriff's Office took the license plate number of a gray van he'd seen parked alongside the northbound lanes of Interstate 35, about 1.5 miles from where the young woman was found. The van was traced to Irving, Texas, but a connection could not be made. There was also a possible sighting of this Jane Doe hitchhiking just north of Austin at around noon the previous day. Though the motorist who witnessed the hitchhiker told police that she matched this woman's description, he could only remember with any kind of certainty that she was wearing blue jeans. An autopsy was performed on the body of the woman found in the I-35 culvert on Thursday, November 1, 1979. The autopsy provided many details that made speculation about the identity or story of who the young woman was open to much presumption and speculation. Her appearance and hygiene were both described as unkempt. Her toenails were much longer than what might be considered normal, and they were dirty, as were her semi-long red-painted fingernails. The young woman's ankles and lower legs were covered with bug bites in differing stages of healing. A bloody napkin was found alongside her body. It was determined that the deceased woman had been using this to control menstrual bleeding in the place of a tampon. It was also determined that she had untreated gonorrhea. The medical examiner discovered salpingitis, a condition that is defined by fallopian tube inflammation and that causes excess fluid secretion and pus collection. Making identification even more difficult and seemingly contradictory to the autopsy evidence that the young woman was excessively unkempt was the fact that her teeth appeared to be very well taken care of, and no cavities or repairs of cavities, such as fillings or crowns, were present. A match to the victim through dental records would be impossible, because it is thought that she'd never had any dental work done. The woman was, however, missing two teeth. The autopsy also showed that she had never broken a bone, rendering identification through medical records as hopeless as dental, and posthumous bruising provided more than ample evidence that she had been dragged to and thrown over the guardrail along the highway and dropped the 7 feet into the concrete culvert. The pathologist's best estimate suggested that the young woman was killed only hours prior to her body being discovered, late the previous day at the earliest. This young woman would come to be known as Orange Socks, a name investigators used that also caught on in the media. The medical examiner determined Orange Socks' cause of death to be asphyxiation by strangulation, and the method was manual. The woman had been choked to death by the perpetrator's bare hands. She had been sexually assaulted. The discovery of the body of the woman known as Orange Socks shocked police not only in Georgetown and Williamson County, but also in neighboring counties, particularly Travis County. Travis County borders Williamson County to the south and is home to the Texas state capital, Austin. Law enforcement there had been rocked by three other murders before the discovery of the woman known as Orange Socks, all within a month period. Owners and namesakes of the M&H liquor store, Molly and Harry Schlesinger, were found wounded in their business by customers who entered the store just before 9 p.m. on Tuesday, October 23, 1979. M&H liquor store was also a bookstore, and even listed in the telephone directory as such, under M&H Bookhouse, the house spelled in the German designation of the word. The couple, both 54 years old, were found shot by a small caliber weapon, Molly once in the back of the head, and Harry was shot in the face, in the stomach, and in the back of the head. Molly was determined dead on arrival to Breckenridge Hospital. Harry died not long after arriving. Travis County Sheriff's Office investigators theorized that the Schlesingers had resisted a burglary and were murdered for their efforts to do so. The store had been robbed on multiple occasions the previous year. As investigators worked the scene, they gasped at the sight of the title of the book that laid on the counter, one in which it appeared Molly had been logging in at the moment the perpetrator of the slaying struck. The book was The Great Texas Murder Trials. The Travis County Sheriff's Office had also been investigating the slaying of 34-year-old Sandra Mae Dobbs, whose body was found on Monday, October 8, 1979. Sandra grew up in a military family who would eventually settle into the St. Louis, Missouri area, where she married and had a daughter. Sandra and her husband divorced in 1978, and she and her daughter moved into an apartment in St. Charles, Missouri. She worked as a receptionist in neighboring Chesterfield, but was seeking better employment in San Antonio, Texas. Sandra had family in the San Antonio area. She preferred the warmer temperatures and thought life was a little more laid back and the people friendlier in the Texas city than in St. Louis. She'd traveled to San Antonio on September 17, 1979, to be interviewed by the Snelling & Snelling Employment Agency for a secretarial position, and was excited when she received a call back from the company to return for a second interview that was to take place on October the 3rd. Her parents worried about their daughter making the long jaunts to and from the Texas city. It's a 14-hour drive. But they also knew that Sandra was the type that was going to do what she wanted to do, so before leaving for her second interview, all parties involved came to a compromise. Sandra would call and check in every 4 hours. On Tuesday, October 2nd, 1979, Sandra's mother received a call from her at approximately 3:15 p.m., Sandra told her parents that about 8 hours into the drive, her 1979 black Dodge started having problems when she was in Atoka, Oklahoma. Her mother suggested that she tie a white kerchief to the antenna of the vehicle, which Sandra had already done, to alert the attention of police if a problem presents itself. A problem had indeed presented itself, and the kerchief did attract the attention of an Oklahoma state trooper when she broke down. The state trooper assisted Sandra in getting her car to a nearby dealership, where a mechanic remedied the issues with the car, allowing Sandra to continue her journey. Since Sandra still had about 6 hours to go, her parents were expecting at least one more phone call from their daughter. However, that phone call never came, and Sandra's parents became anxious. They weren't the only ones who became worried. When Sandra failed to show up at her cousin's house in San Antonio that evening, he was sure that she was stranded somewhere between his house and where she'd last called her parents. He got into his vehicle and headed north up I-35 in search of his cousin. At about 1 a.m., now Wednesday, October 3rd, 1979, Sandra's cousin located her car in the southbound lane near William Cannon Drive exit in Austin. There was no white kerchief on the antenna, and the car was locked as though it had been purposely left. Sandra's cousin continued frantically searching for her, checking car repair shops and motels, becoming increasingly worried at every subsequent stop that provided no leads. That worry built up to overwhelming fear by 7 p.m. that night, when he called the police to report her missing. Police found no evidence of a struggle in the black Dodge car, as well as no fingerprints. Only her purse and flashlight were missing from the vehicle. Though relatives felt Sandra would not have left her car, the undisturbed scene provided few other possibilities. Police immediately began searching along I-35 and William Cannon Drive, scavenging creek beds, culverts, and tall brush for clues as to what happened to Sandra or which direction she might have gone. Investigators feared the worst, though, that Sandra had been abducted by someone who posed as a concerned passerby, but instead took the opportunity to abduct the woman. A Mississippi resident who had been traveling through that part of I-35 that Tuesday evening told police that she saw a tall white male beside a broken-down car with a small woman. Sandra stood only 4 feet 10 inches and weighed only 110 pounds. The witness would later provide additional details, police said, through hypnosis. Police searchers mainly concentrated their efforts on searching in and around creeks, and when commenting why, an officer told reporters that they have had a lot of rapes reported recently around Slaughter Creek. It is unclear what the officer meant by a lot. Sandra's parents came down to aid in the search for their daughter. A local 17-year-old high school student who was assigned to the Youth Police Service detail was recruited, as he was the only one small enough to lower into particular manholes in the search for Sandra Mae Dubbs. On Sunday, October 7, 1979, a Department of Public Safety worker came forward with Sandra's billfold, though the individual found the wallet the week prior alongside the northbound lane of I-35. The next day at 2 p.m., Monday, October 8, 1979, Sandra Mae Dubbs' body was found in a clump of trees in a field behind a television production company by an employee of the business, about 2 miles south of where her car had been found. Her clothing was scattered and strewn all over the grassy field. Police were able to locate miscellaneous jewelry with metal detectors, but the antique gold and diamond watch and diamond and ruby ring she was known to have been wearing were not located. The weapons that were used in the perpetration of the unimaginably gruesome attack against Sandra could also not be found. Sandra's badly decomposed body was found completely unclothed. She'd been stabbed so many times that it was impossible for investigators to count at the scene, but the medical examiner would later count 35 stab wounds in her chest, neck, and arms. Sandra had been cut in a single slice that began at her wrist, traveled up her arm, down her chest, past her stomach, and finally ending in the pelvic area. The medical examiner said that though specific medical evidence of rape could not be satisfactorily isolated, there was no doubt that Sandra had been sexually assaulted. The scene provided virtually no clues as to who the perpetrator of this horrible and terrifying act could be. There is an unfortunate common factor in all the cases discussed on this episode, excluding the murder of Lisa Rhea Haley. This factor was present in another case we covered, the abduction and murder of Susie Mages, and quite frankly, it pains me to have to bring it up and discuss it in more detail than we did in Susie's case. The commonality, Henry Lee Lucas, becomes more maddening each time it comes up. Not only because his confessions slowed and potentially altered the progress of so many unsolved cases for the worse, but also because seemingly fame-seeking lawmen ate right out of Lucas's hands, and in some cases even hand-fed him details and information that would lead him to confess or allowed him to back up his confessions. Henry Lee Lucas was convicted in a court of law and sentenced to death for the murder of Orange Socks because of his confession. Of course, Lucas recanted on virtually every single confession he'd ever made, and even told a news reporter in the late 90s, quote, "I made the police look stupid. I was out to wreck Texas law enforcement," end quote. And did he ever? Texas Governor George Bush would commute Lucas's death sentence for reasons officially listed as not ample evidence of guilt, seeming to ignore that witnesses placed Lucas in Florida at the time Orange Socks was killed, and even further ignoring the allegations that Williamson County lawmen had shown Lucas the crime scene photos before he even decided to confess to this particular crime. In 1986, the Texas Attorney General's office released the Lucas Report, which documents Lucas as working on October 31st, 1979, in Florida, the day the Jane Doe known as Orange Socks was killed. Henry Lee Lucas's confession to the murders of Molly and Harry Schlesinger were no different in terms of their complete lack of validity. Molly Schlesinger's grandchild provided an account of what the family had come to believe about the murders of Molly and Harry in a Reddit post that provides incredible insight. After Lucas's confession in 1985 to the murders of Molly and Harry, with Otis Toole as his accomplice, investigators convinced Molly's son of Lucas's guilt, thus perpetuating a nearly family-wide belief that it was indeed Lucas who murdered the couple. However, according to the Lucas Report, Lucas had not only worked in Florida, but he'd also cashed a check for that day's work there at Byright Supermarket on the day Molly and Harry were murdered. There are also allegations made that when Lucas begins a confession, but is providing details that the investigator isn't happy with, the tapes shut off and return with Lucas providing details that match the crime and or the crime scene more closely. And there are allegations still that police circled what was M&H Liquor Store and Bookhouse several times, waiting for Lucas to point it out as the crime scene. And finally, upon Lucas's silence on the matter, the investigator allegedly said, "Henry, isn't that the place where you and Otis killed that man and woman?" Lucas's memory at that point miraculously returned, and he affirmed that the building was indeed the place. Lucas was never tried for the murders of Molly and Harry Schlesinger, and the case remains unsolved. Henry Lee Lucas also confessed to the murder of Sandra Dubbs, and although the Lucas Report does not document him as working on the very day she was murdered, he was working and cashed a check in Jacksonville, Florida, in the days before, and he was also working 2 days after the murder, was again issued a check for that day of work, and again cashed it. Even with a 2-day discrepancy, it is of course incredibly unlikely Lucas had anything to do with Sandra Dubbs' murder. His ties to Texas seem to be almost non-existent around this time, and no one can place him here except for himself and the law enforcement officers who were so desperate to clear cases. Henry Lee Lucas and the Lucas Task Force was, perhaps, the second coming of the dark ages of Texas justice. Lucas also confessed to the murders of a young couple that took place a year before Orange Socks, Sandra Dubbs, Molly Schlesinger, and Harry Schlesinger, that baffled police in Williamson County. Luckily, Henry Lee Lucas can be completely left out of the explanation as to why his confession was contrived on this particular tragedy, though. As Frank Keyes and Rita Salazar were traveling north on I-35 on their way back to their Georgetown homes after seeing the movie Midnight Express at an Austin movie theater on Sunday night, November 5, 1978, sometime between 11 p.m. and midnight, Frank's car ran out of gas in Round Rock. 18-year-old Rita and 19-year-old Frank had only begun dating a few days before. In fact, they'd just met at a Halloween party. It was theorized at the time that Rita and Frank had hitchhiked for a ride to a gas station, gas can in tow. They'd never made it to get fuel, though, as both of the late teenage couple were found the following day, riddled with bullet holes from a .22 caliber gun. Frank Key's body was found in Round Rock, not far from the car, lying face down in an overgrown, grassy drainage ditch. He had been shot 9 times. Rita Salazar's body was found just south of Waco, about 60 miles north of where Frank's body had been found. She had been shot 6 times. Rita Salazar had been raped before she was shot to death. She'd held her white sweater in front of her as she was shot, an instinctive defense that, of course, did little to protect her from the weapon's trajectories. Fortunately, in the year 2000, a Williamson County detective, working Frank and Rita's then cold case, requested that Rita's panties be submitted to DNA testing, and material was able to be obtained. It was entered into the Combined DNA Index System, or CODIS. In 2007, a man named Benny T. Arena Jr. had his DNA taken as the result of a revoked probation. It was entered into CODIS in 2008 and was a direct hit for the material found on Rita Salazar's underwear. At his trial in 2012, almost 34 years after the slaying of Frank Keyes and the sexual assault and murder of Rita Salazar, T. Arena implicated two friends in the murders and sexual assault, claiming only to have masturbated, ejaculating into Rita's panties. He even went so far as to claim that he begged his friends to stop as they continued to rape Rita in the back seat of the vehicle through Williamson, Bell, Falls, and McLennan counties. A depraved and lying coward to the end, no doubt. Investigators were unable to locate these supposed friends. T. Arena admitted guilt in the case of Rita Salazar only as the terms of his plea deal required and was sentenced to a slap on the wrist of 40 years, of which he must serve a third before being eligible for parole. It has been nearly 40 years since the body of the Jane Doe known as Orange Socks was found, and her identity, like who killed her, remains a mystery. She was buried in the Oddfellows Cemetery in Georgetown, her grave marked only Unidentified Woman, 1979. In 1981, then Williamson County Sheriff Jim Boutwell remarked that he had found what he called cheap plastic flowers at the uncared-for grave of Orange Socks on all three of his visits there. "Maybe we ought to stake out the cemetery to see who's doing it," Boutwell is quoted as saying, his frustration with the mystery behind the young woman's identity apparent. Finally, in May of 2018, with a fresh sheriff who vowed to give cold cases more attention in the county, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office finally decided that it was time to make a technological attempt to discover who Orange Socks was. The department announced through the press that they would attempt to identify the manufacturer of the Orange Socks, examine the ring she was wearing more closely, and get a DNA profile of the young woman. In October 2018, after seeking to obtain the Orange Socks Jane Doe's DNA profile to help identify her, law enforcement got word from the lab of something huge and something they didn't expect at all. The presence of DNA from another individual was also found. If you have any information on the identity of the Orange Socks Jane Doe, or any other information you feel might be relevant to her case, please contact the Williamson County Sheriff's Office at 512-943-5204. If you have any information about the murders of Molly and Harry Schlesinger, Sandra Dubbs, or Lisa Rhea Haley, please contact Texas Crime Stoppers at 1-800-252-8477. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to our friend Kim Smith for her help in research for this episode. Thanks, Kim. The Waco Tribune, the Austin Statesman, the Dallas Morning News, KWTX-TV Waco, and the 1986 Texas Attorney General's Lucas Report were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. You can interact with Gone Cold Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by searching Gone Cold Podcast. Also, please join us on our Facebook discussion group. There are a ton of good folks interacting over there, and we'd love to have you. If you're interested in all things true crime, you should probably check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you'll find well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is an amazing resource for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Check it out. Thanks for listening, y'all.